Welcome to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Gregory Burns, author of Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently, Part 2 of 2. Hi, I'm Nathan Ives, and I would like to welcome you to this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast, an interview with Gregory Burns, author of Iconoclast, A Neuroscientist Reveals How to Think Differently, Part 2 of 2. The Strategy Driven Podcast focuses on the tools and techniques executives and managers can use to improve their organization's alignment and accountability to ultimately achieve superior results. These podcasts elaborate on the best practice and warning flag posts found on the Strategy Driven website at www.strategydriven.com. In this special edition podcast, Gregory Burns, author of Iconoclast and distinguished chair of neuroeconomics at Emory University, shares with us what makes Iconoclasts so astoundingly creative and successful. And so now, without any further delay, let's get started. Greg, you know, there are sometimes environments I find in the workplace that create a certain level of fear. And in the nuclear industry that I work in, we actually have a term for it. We call it a chilling work environment. Yeah. And it's something we look out for. Are there certain actions that executives and managers can take to reduce the fear level within their organizations and try to help spur some creativity?
I think, yeah, certainly there are. But not all corporations are open to that. Okay. Because, it depends a lot on the culture of the company. And it depends a lot on the leadership of the company and whether that's the kind of culture that you want to foster. Most large companies have divisions, R&D divisions, and specifically divisions related to innovative research and innovation in general. How effective those are, you know, I think depends a lot on the mechanism by which ideas filter up. And the kind of the core issue is it a filter or is it a choking funnel where ideas have to essentially run the gauntlet of kind of being shot down, and those things that eventually survive at the end of the day are the ones that eventually get implemented or tested.
Okay.
Now, clearly, you know, you need some kind of process to evaluate the viability of ideas and the potential. But my sense is that this varies widely from company to company and depends very much on the culture. And in many companies, it ends up being a funnel that is driven, you know, not necessarily by the merit of specific ideas, but more by what's been called theater, the ability to dramatize and sell an idea based more on the personality of the person as opposed to the merits of the idea.
All right.
Oftentimes, the people with the most innovative ideas are also people who have the most fear of being shot down. I don't want to say that's always the case, but it is often the case, especially in technology. High-tech industries, you know, some of the most creative people are, you know, the engineers and the people working on the front lines, who know the business, who know kind of the tech, but because of their training, don't, you know, have the training in social skills, social presentations, and often get shot down for reasons that have nothing to do with the idea itself. So how companies structure this process is critical. Companies that, you know, foster a culture of dissent, of diversity, and I'm not talking about diversity in kind of the shallow sense. I'm talking about, you know, companies that set up filters that allow ideas to come through, you know, and actually, you know, want their employees to debate the ideas and not simply in a way, kind of like in a yes man type of way to ascend the corporate ladder.
Okay.
But that's rare. Those companies, I think, are rare. Some they're out there.
They are. And I mentioned this in the last episode of the Strategy Driven Podcast. I'm fortunate that the company I work for, which is Deloitte Consulting, is one of those companies where we do encourage a lot of ideas to come forward and have an environment that the ideas are looked at based on their own merit, and it's not so presentation focused, and that people are always encouraged to come forward with their ideas, and there's a respect and an appreciation for the diversity of thought within the organization. But at the same time, I can also relate to the bottleneck, that I've seen in other organizations that chokes off those good ideas.
I agree, and I think a lot of it comes from the leadership of the particular company and whether the culture is one of top down or bottom up.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, it doesn't work well in a top down organization.
Okay. Yeah, I hadn't thought of it in that perspective before, but you're absolutely right. As I think now on the organizations where it was things were choked off, they were very top down organizations, very directive in their leadership style from above to below.
Right.
Greg, the last principle that you had mentioned was social intelligence. And regarding social intelligence, in Iconoclast, you presented an illustration of how people would tend to act in a manner that was consistent with the group that they were in, even if they were undecided or in some cases believed the action the group was taking was actually the wrong action. And oftentimes in the work that I do, that struck me as relating to what we call groupthink in the area of decision making. I was wondering if there was some things that executives and managers could do that would help to create an environment where we avoid the groupthink mentality.
Yes, absolutely. So it is absolutely groupthink. Now, what I've done, and this is actually kind of the core idea of the book, is mm-hmm. We did a brain imaging experiment several years ago in which we tried to understand groupthink at a physiological level.
Okay.
The basic question is, the question is not whether groupthink exists or not. It does. I think mm-hmm. we all know that. The question is it because people are essentially, they look out at the world and they have their own opinion about it. They're just afraid to voice it for various social reasons,
mm-hmm.
or when you're in a group situation, does it actually kind of change the way you see the world? Now, everything I said about perception suggests that may be possibly part of what goes on in a committee or a group situation, that not only are they thinking the same, but they actually start to see things the same way, physiologically.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which actually makes, if that's the case, then it actually makes it a much more difficult and insidious problem to deal with, because then you might not even have any awareness of it.
Okay.
So, for example, 5-star ratings are everywhere now. You go on Amazon, you see
yeah.
rated 5 stars. Does simply seeing that 5-star rating actually make you like it more? Do you see it in a different way?
Okay.
All the evidence that we're getting from neuroscience suggests that yes, it does. Maybe not totally, but it certainly does influence how you perceive the world. So in committee-type situations or group or team situations, whatever the specific format is, there are some things that I think can be done to mitigate that. Now, we all work and function in groups and teams and committees, some better than others. And the premise of doing that is the ideal premise is that you get a group of people together, and if you aggregate their opinions and their judgments, the group will come to a better decision than any individual would by themselves, because
yes,
you've somehow aggregated different points of view.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that when you get a group of people together, they cease to be independent, and they start thinking more alike. So for groups to really work efficiently and to achieve their best, their potential, you need to set up structures that allow people to maintain their own judgments without being fully influenced by the group. So, for example, things that kill that type of process are committees. Let's pick a committee, for example. Many committees I've seen and been on kind of either explicitly or implicitly come to decisions unanimously.
All right.
I think that's terrible. I mean, why have a committee that has to come to a unanimous decision?
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially saying right out of the gates, you all have to think alike at the end of the day.
Okay.
Strangely enough, our judicial system requires that, but from juries.
Yes.
And there's, you can demonstrate from a number of angles, mathematically, physiologically, that, simply removing that constraint leads to better decision-making by groups, because it allows for minority dissent. It doesn't require everyone to think alike.
Okay.
That's the simplest thing.
Okay.
But having sat on many committees myself, even if it's not explicitly a requirement, it ends up being an implicit requirement just by human nature that people do not want to dissent unless it's actively encouraged. And that's, I think, the role of organizations, is to actively encourage that, because human nature being what it is, people won't do it on their own.
Okay. And if you don't mind, my bouncing a thought off the wall, one of the things that we have talked about on the Strategy Driven website on several occasions is the use of what we call a devil's advocate, and
yep,
that's implanting the contrarian, or someone, even if they don't have the opposite point of view, they're supposed to ask questions and take that opposing point of view just to stir up the mix and get people to think in different perspectives. Is that something that could help break up that groupthink from this perspective also?
I hadn't thought of that, but that sounds like a great idea.
Okay. Well, hey, I'm glad then that we have that as one of our best practices. and I don't have to go back and put in disclaimers on that one. But it's something that I've seen work at a lot of nuclear plants, is we've encouraged the use of it's just what we call is the devil's advocate.
Yeah.
To try to get us away from groupthink and away from what we often characterize as the organization or the cultural biases that over time we as a group of folks with a shared history, and in the utility business, there's often a lot of folks that have been at a certain plant or a given plant for a very long period of time. So our history is common,
right,
and our biases tend to be common. So it's very easy for us to get into the groupthink mode.
Right.
Excellent.
And you serve on these groups with the same people. It's like,
mm-hmm,
like, I know what Joe's thinking. I don't even need to ask him, right? And it's very
yeah,
easy to get lulled into that, and that contributes to that as well.
Okay. Now, Greg, it struck me as I read the book that iconoclasts really bring a lot of advantages to an organization, in that they have a unique perspective, they've got kind of an entrepreneurial spirit, and then they have the social intelligence too to take those ideas and those unique concepts and get them driven up the organization and actually implemented. How do executives and managers go about identifying iconoclasts within their organization? And then kind of as an extension of that, if they want to bring some folks into their organization that are iconoclasts, how would they go about identifying them during the hiring process so that they would have that opportunity?
Well, I think it's easier, obviously, those two questions, it's easier to identify them if they're already there because their actions essentially tip them off. But I think it's difficult. It may be difficult in the hiring process because, you know, I don't think there's kind of a stress test interview, you know, for iconoclasm.
Okay.
You know, and, you know, I think, you know, you still see those kinds of interviews, you know, where people give you scenarios and it's like, what would you do? I'm not sure if those are truly effective at identifying people who are ultimately successful, you know, versus people who can think on their feet and verbalize an answer in a pleasing way to the interviewer. So it may be very difficult up front to identify them. But I will tell you, as a biologist, I will throw out the possibility of looking for neural signatures that may be a tip-off.
Okay.
It's controversial, it's illegal, it's unethical, but it's possible.
Okay.
How's that?
Okay. Well, in that case, I probably won't recommend that our listeners then actively pursue that.
Well, I'm half serious about it because I do get asked that quite often. You know, is there some fMRI task that we can do that could help us identify people who would be good at such and such a job?
Okay.
And the answer is, well, maybe. Maybe there is.
Yeah.
But do you really want to break that ground and go in that direction?
Yeah. I guess the closest I've seen some organizations, or when I was getting my MBA, and it was not at Emory, but it was just up the street at Kennesaw State University. One of the things we did is we took several, like, MBTI exams, personality exams,
right,
to try to help our team composition. But as I read Iconoclast and you talked about the brain scans and the like, and being able to do some of the identification, I thought, wow, you know, that would be cool. But I didn't imagine being able to do that, and that's why I thought I'd ask if there was another way to maybe go about it.
There might be, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay.
I certainly think it's feasible to identify people's potential for iconoclasm and innovation based on brain scans, but the solid research hasn't been done on that.
Okay.
But having looked at, you know, 1,000 of these over the last decade, you start to see patterns emerge. It's more of a question of is that kind of the way we really want to hire people and make promotion decisions?
Mm-hmm.
Because the problem with doing that is that they're kind of a slice in time picture. That's just a snapshot of a, even if it worked, it would be a snapshot in time of that person, and that it would probably have prognostic value over the short term.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But who knows? You know, you what we've seen is that, you know, people get thrown into circumstances that nobody could foresee, and sometimes it's hard to predict who will cut it and who won't.
Okay. All right.
That's what makes it interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, for folks that are in our organization and we have the ability to directly observe them, could we reasonably then, do you think, be able to evaluate or judge whether they have some of these traits or embody some of the principles of iconoclasm?
Let me answer the question differently.
Okay.
I think it's more interesting. I think let's say you could identify various traits about perception and the fear
mm-hmm.
response, maybe even social intelligence, and you can identify traces in the brain that are somehow correlated with these skills. I think it would be far more productive and interesting to devise training regimens that would augment them.
Oh, okay.
And there's a very rapidly growing area in brain research known as real-time fMRI feedback, where basically you use the response, the brain responses in real time and feed it back as a type of biofeedback for the person and use it as a training device.
Oh, okay.
That's completely feasible, and that's, you know, that's doable now.
Okay. You know, we've talked about a lot of things that executives and managers can do that would encourage kind of an iconoclastic behavior within people in their organizations. I was wondering if there were any key, what I call warning flags, or maybe their organizational characteristics that leaders ought to be on the lookout for, because they might in some way create an environment that inhibits creative behavior?
Culture of fear, probably the biggest killer.
Okay.
Obviously, if people are afraid to express their judgments and their opinions, then you're not going to get them. And
okay.
That's the biggest killer there. I think the most successful companies in terms of innovation are ones that, you know, do not have that. The worst companies do. You know, people are afraid for their jobs and, you know, will hew to more of a conformity line in those types of companies.
Okay. All righty.
Well, and I think you know the kinds of companies I'm talking about that have that.
Yeah, and I know I've mentioned that, you know, I'm in a great company right now, but I have had firsthand experience in the past with those kind of companies, and it was a shoot the messenger was a very commonplace thing. And we had a term called career limiting event. And, you know, certainly if you put forth an idea that was contrary to the direction the organization wanted to go, or, you know, maybe unbeknownst to you, it was just contrary to something someone higher in the organization wanted to do or direction they wanted to go in, it all of a sudden came down on you. And so
right.
you learned over time that being quiet was probably the better approach.
Yeah.
Yeah. So unfortunately, I can relate to that. And fortunately today, like I said before, I'm in an extremely open culture that really does foster creativity and ideas.
Yeah, and I think the openness, the transparency is critical. You know, in cultures, in cultures where things are not open, where there's not a lot of transparency in how decisions are made, that
mm-hmm.
fosters fear because you don't know what's going on. That's, you know, that's
okay.
obvious. But, you know, you asked me what things companies can do, and, you know, in order to foster openness and innovation, transparency is highly effective at that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's a great insight. That is a great insight. Greg, before we close, I did want to mention to our listeners that you have a website, and I have visited it. Your website's at www.ccnl.emory.edu/Greg, and I'm going to put that link up on the website so that it's with the podcast. On that website, you had links to several other papers that you had authored. I believe there's another book that's also listed.
Okay.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your website and kind of describe some of the resources our listeners would find there.
Well, the website is really my academic website, so mm-hmm. you will find all of my academic papers there if you're interested in getting into the nuts and bolts of brain research. All of that's freely available.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn about specific experiments that we're currently doing in brain imaging, which can run the gamut from studying the teenage brain up to adult decision making.
And if
you live in the Atlanta area, you can volunteer.
Oh, really? Okay. How would someone go about volunteering, if I might ask? Because as we talked about earlier, I live in Atlanta, so.
Oh, very easy. You just send an email or call up the project coordinator listed on our main website, and there should be a link there for volunteering or participating in a study.
Okay. All right. I will try to find that link also and put that on the website as well for the posting for anyone who lives in Atlanta and would like to consider volunteering. Greg, I wanted to thank you again not only for your time, but for the insights that you've shared with us on how executives and managers can promote a more creative work environment. And I personally believe or have found that it's through those things that do promote this more creative work environment, like an absence of fear and like differing perspectives and coming together of unique thoughts, that really heightens an organization's performance. I really enjoyed your book, and I thoroughly enjoyed the insights you presented about being an iconoclast. And I would recommend to our listeners that they go out and pick up a copy. And of course, we'll have a link to that on the website as well. And I know they can also get it at their favorite bookstore and, of course, on Amazon online as well. So thank you for joining us.
It's been great being here. I really enjoyed it, too.
And that concludes our two-part interview series with Gregory Burns, author of Iconoclast. I hope you enjoyed this special edition of the Strategy Driven Podcast and would like to personally thank Greg for being with us and sharing his insights on Iconoclast. As always, we would appreciate receiving your feedback by email at podcast@strategydriven.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider voting for us on Podcast Alley and visiting our website at www.strategydriven.com. You can find more information about Gregory Burns and his insights on Iconoclast at www.ccnl.emory.edu/Greg. Until next time, so long.